Again, I'd like to welcome you to today's TechNet webcast. This is Microsoft.com Operations, introduces Real World Debugging, determining when you have a problem and initial debugging. Today's presenter is Jeff Johnson. Before we go over to Jeff Johnson, I'd like to introduce Chris Adams, who is our IS Product Group Program Manager. So Chris, you've got the floor.
Awesome, Janet, and thank you, and welcome, everybody. This is Chris Adams, and I am playing my famous role from last November called Master of Ceremonies. It's a cool title. Thought I would come along and do it again. Actually, in fact, Jeff and his colleagues have asked me to please do that again. So before we get started and we turn it over to everybody listening to Jeff, because he has all the details you're looking for, I do want to say that after a little bit of relaxation, rejuvenation, and some overall time off, the IS Webcast series is back. It is in full-blown capability for now until the end of the year. So we thought we'd start the year off with a very strong week-long series coming along from the Microsoft.com Operations Debug team. But before we turn it over to start the first thing, the one thing that you want to make sure is that you want to go back to the prerequisite. And it's not really absolutely necessary that you do this, but Microsoft.com troubleshooting and debugging web hosting environments. You spoke loudly last November when you said that this was a top-notch presentation. The problem being is we only gave it 90 minutes, and we tried to present all the different areas and aspects in that 90 minutes. You wanted more of it, so what we did is bring them back and gave each individual presenter from that presentation their own 90-minute slot. They're going to be here Monday through Friday as part of the IS Webcast series, a real-world look into debugging at Microsoft.com Operations. Make sure you do not miss that opportunity to all of these webcasts that we have coming up here. As you're going to see here, you always can visit www.iswebcastseries.com to see the latest presentations that are in the IS Webcast series. The way that you do that for this week's series, as you can see, we're starting with the top one here on the 27th of March, and then we'll dig in and let Jeff Stuckey and his ding tell us the rest of his information about real-world debugging. With all that said, let me go ahead and introduce Jeff Johnson, a senior systems engineer at Microsoft Corporation. He's going to really try to set up and frame all of this week's presentations. He's going to give you a lot of good information. Have your pencil and your paper ready as he introduces real-world debugging. The first step is always determining when you have a problem and how to do that initial debugging. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. And Jeff, run away and teach us about how to do debugging.
Thank you, Chris. And it's good to be here today. And as was introduced way too many times, we're going to be talking about how to start the debug process, how to figure out what your problem is, and what to do with it. And to start that, oh boy, we're having technical difficulties here. Getting my slide deck going. There we go. So, some prerequisites. We kind of assume that you know something about IIS, otherwise you wouldn't be looking at the IIS web series, TechNet series here. And we also assume you are doing something with IT infrastructure, and have been having problems with it, either CPU usage or similar issues. We also are going to be doing some stuff with ASP.NET 2.0. A lot of stuff we're doing here will actually retroactively fit into the 1.1 version of ASP.NET. However, our focus going forward will continue to be the latest and greatest things that the Microsoft teams produce. Our agenda is an introduction, which we've kind of gone through, some general information on finding issues and how to monitor machines, just a real-life covering here. Then we're going to go into some specific examples, looking at memory usage, CLR exceptions, CPU usage, file system usage, latency, and then we'll have a summary graphed all up. Along the way, we'll have some demos. Discovering issues. So there are a number of ways you can find out you have a problem. The easiest for you, but probably the worst, is to wait until a customer tells you that you've got a problem. And they always seem to find them, even when you think you've got your bases covered fairly well. But, you know, customers don't want to see errors. They're coming to use your site, not improve it. Right? And the customer who has to find your errors will go find somebody else's non-error page. Right? You can also wait for your content providers. Here at Microsoft.com, we have hundreds of people who actually produce our content. And many of them do a good job of monitoring their content and reporting when something's not working. However, not all of them do. And some of them push their content up and then never really look at it until they're going to push their next version of the content. So if something breaks in the middle, they might not notice where we come in. That's not a very good way to run an enterprise level engineering system. So we're going to focus on finding it for yourself. And this is how to do it right. You find out, you seek and find the issues. You proactively go looking for problems in your website. You don't wait for others to come in and tell you something's wrong. And the best place to do this is actually in a pre-production environment. Like, find it before the customers can see it. Take care of it before the customers can see it. Now that makes this grand assumption that system engineers are involved in pre-production code construction. Right? You are involved in making sure that what's going to go out on the web is good before it gets there. Not waiting for it to get there and then run around with the sky falling on you, trying to get somebody to fix a problem that you noticed. Right. So, to find issues, what do you need? Well, you need to have a data source. Places where you can go find out what is going on the machine. And these are all the same old obvious things, right? Task manager. Pull up task manager and see how your CPU is doing, and how your memory is doing, and how your network is doing. Right? If they're high, then we can start investigating things. Right? If they're abnormal, we can start investigating things. System monitor or perfmon. You know, there's way too much information in here to list all on this slide. But we will go into a few of the counters that we care about and what to do about them. The event viewer and the event logging system. Again, lots of great data if you can get the data out of it. And there are key pieces of data that are kind of hidden in all the text. And getting that data and being able to use it is the important thing. There's also service logs, right? IIS logs or SQL logs or all kinds of logs that we can parse and find interesting data. But once again, there's even more waiting through valid cases to find those invalid ones. So how do you move from getting the data from the data source into your email box or into your queue to figure out what you should work on? Well, the obvious solution is Microsoft Operations Manager, MOM, which is a great tool, and there's plenty of ways for you to find out information about that, so we're not going to concentrate on that as much for this webcast. We do use MOM for multiple situations here at Microsoft.com. I believe in the last webcast we did, we had some good conversations about our use of MOM. There are some other ways to get that information out of the log files and out of the event logs and into your box. One of them is System Monitor. Perfmon does a great job of collecting information and holding up. Event Viewer, another good way to get data. Log Parser, which is my favorite tool, and I can't have a presentation without bringing it up. In fact, a lot of the demos I do today are going to be around using Log Parser to mine data from the different data fields, different data sources. Now, how to get notified? Well, if you're using MOM, you can use these other tools to generate the data and then have MOM send you that data, which, again, we do that quite a bit here at Microsoft.com. But the other way to do it is, you know, roll your own SMTP package. You know, take a little bash file or a little script that can fire off SMTP email to you to yourself with the data that you want, maybe you've been collecting and parsing. So let's start with the event log. And I think we've all probably gone into the event log and seen an event and wondered, well, that's useful information, but how many of those have I seen today? Or when was the last time this kind of event came up? Similar kind of questions. Right? There are a few automation approaches. You can use WMI from a script, which, again, we're not going to get into that, even though it's a very useful way to do it. Why? Well, because I like log parser. I'm a system administrator, and I came from a command line background. And so anything I can do in a command line, I like to do in a command line. So we're going to start with log parser. The other interesting thing with log parser is you can script it as well. Those who haven't seen the log parser webcast before. So we could take our same queries that we run at command line and push them into a script and then have that script push out email right to us. So interesting things to look for in the event log, and this is by no means, you know, the end-all, be-all list of things in the event log. This is just a few things that I've thought of. We can look for ASP.NET errors, exceptions or otherwise. We can find W3WP crashes. And also W3WP recycles. You know, with IS6, the great improvements over IS5 are around that worker process model, and they do a wonderful job of logging information when that process disappears for whatever reason. We can also, if we want to, get into the security logs and find out when a given user was on or off the machine, when they come on and when they go off. And while I won't be showing that today, it's pretty trivial to do based on the same technology that I will be showing. So let's start mining some data out of the event log using log parser. I'll jump to the sharing slide and make sure that it's all working fine. Great. So if we just start with a simple query, actually before we start with a simple query, let's look at our event viewer and see what interesting stuff has happened on our system. Lots of wonderful, interesting stuff. Maybe or may not be. Since I'm doing web server stuff today, let's look at the W3 service one. A process serving application pool, default app pool terminated unexpectedly. The process ID is 3168. The process code was a bunch of numbers that may or may not matter to us. So, there's nice information, but we have no idea how often we've seen this error, how regularly we've seen this error, or if there's a pattern to the times of day we see this error. And while we could scroll down through the event log and try to find all the cases where this happened, it would be much better if we could automate that process of mining the data. And that's what we're going to do. So while we leave this prompt up with the properties, so we can see the string involved here, the description, let's go find out a little bit about log parser. And I happen to have the EXE version of log parser in my path. And I'm going to just type log parser first and see the different parameters we can use. Now this is a huge step. The thing we're going to focus on is an input type, which is the dash I, and we're going to be looking at the EVT input type, event viewer input type. And then we'll have to have a query that will help us with that. So if we look at log parser dash H dash I EVT, this will give us the help message specific for that input type. Now, the reason we want to do that, dash H dash I colon EVT, is to find out what fields we can take. Now, log parser, for those who don't know, takes a SQL query language. And so we can do queries like select star from system, meaning system log, and then, or we can say select a specific field, like in this case, I think we'll do message. So if we say log parser dash I EVT select message from system, I'm going to put a where in here, where source name equals W3SVC. If you remember, from our event viewer properties window, that was what the source name said. Now you notice that I have a mixture of capitalization and non-capitalization in log parser. Other than the stuff inside the single quotes, which is hopefully that part right there, everything else is case insensitive, but things inside single quotes tend to be case sensitive. So that's just a good thing to remember. So if we select a message where the source name is W3 service, it dumps out a bunch of messages. A process serving application pool default reported a failure. And that looks similar to what we saw in the event viewer. Now, that's nice, but that string is awfully long. The happy thing is I understand how the event viewer works, so I know that if instead we look at message, if we look at the strings column, this is all the key information without the text goop. So you notice default app pool, 2564 and 0. Right. So 0 is the error number that was returned. So if we start doing some interesting stuff now, we can get the app pool and the process ID right out of the strings by using the extract token function in log parser. Extract token takes three parameters. It takes the thing you want to parse. It takes the index in that string of the thing you want. In this case, we're looking for the app pool ID, which seems to be the first thing. First snippet, as it were. First token. And then it also takes the thing that delimits the different tokens inside your string. So in this case, it's that pipe symbol. So now if we hit enter on this one, we now have the application pool name for the things that we care about. So how good is that? Well, that's pretty good. But I'm going to skip over and look at a file I created, which does just exactly that to a point. You'll see that we have that same extract token with the pipe sign. Now, in this case, we're using a case statement because there are some event IDs that are a different format than the ones we were looking at. So when the event ID is 1074, we don't want to look at the first item, the 0 index token. We want to look at the 1 index token, or the second token in the string. And in either case, we're just going to call this thing that we get back, @pool_id. And then we're going to use the @pool_id and the event ID, and we're going to count and see how many of these we have. At the same time, we're going to do something kind of interesting and fun. We're going to find the last time one of these events was generated, so the max time generated. We're going to call that max time. Again, we still have the source name equals W3Service. And we have to do a group by, because we're doing these counts, we have to group together all the same @pool IDs and event IDs. So if we run this little command, log parser, we tell it which file we want to use. In this case, the file is w3wp-uptime.sql. When we hit enter, it now dumps out each @pool ID, the event ID related to that, and if we went out on the internet, we can find out what each of these events means, and we could actually do a case statement and drop out a nice user-friendly string if we wanted to. And then we have a total, which is how many times we saw this event, and then the max time, which is the last time we saw this event. So from this, we can then, you know, we're probably doing some post-analysis to look through this stuff, and we could say, hey, look, and we're getting a pool cycle, whichever event ID that happens to be. You know, on the last, we've got 21 of them, and it happened, last one happened at 1540. And I'm saying 21 and recycling, but I'm not actually sure if that 1039 really is the pool cycle. I can't remember off the top of my head. Now, this is fine, but it's a little hard to read. And so one thing I've done is I've edited this nice little script using the case statement technology LogParser provides. I'm going to uncomment out this code, comment out the other code. We're going to run this one. Now, if we look at this one, you'll see that there's an @pool ID, and then there's a number of columns, like rapid fail, terminate, ping fail. These are the different reasons on my machine why I had failures. And how did I find these out? I just went out on the internet and did a quick little search for MSDN. Again, we're still finding out @pool ID, the exact same way we were before. But now we're looking at the event ID, and if it matches a certain event ID, we're setting it to 1. Otherwise, we're returning a 0. And we're naming this thing _rapid_fail. And then we're taking the sum of all those 1s and 0s and calling that rapid fail. And that will give us the number of times we've seen this event. And the nice thing is, the view becomes just a little bit nicer. So if we switch back to our command prompt, and we run the same file, maybe, we'll just delete that. We'll make it work. Okay, I forgot to save. Great. So now the view has gone from being rows, which all have the same @pool, to being a single row for each @pool, and the different columns represent the different event IDs. So now we can see that reported fail is event ID 1039. And under debugger, we've had 9 of those. That was the event ID 1082. So we go from something that's a little harder to read to something that's a lot easier to read, just by adding a few case statements in there and doing some quick sums. Now you notice that we can only do one thing at a time here, because each column is only going to have one instance of the row. So if we wanted to see the max times, we'd have to go back to our data, our SQL query. Let's comment out that little piece, and let's uncomment the code that in this case is going to dump out the max times, in other words, the last times each of these things was seen. And obviously I need a little bit more of a scroll bar for my CMD prompt to be able to get them all in one nice row. But we have the app pool ID, we have the last time a rapid fail occurred, the last time terminated or ping failed, these are different columns. That lets us get a little more information post-mortem to monitor how our site is doing. Are we seeing a lot of ping failures? If so, then we need to go figure out what to investigate on a ping failure. How often is it happening? For us at Microsoft.com, we actually wrote a script that uses this exact same kind of query, but instead of summing them all up and finding just the max, it goes through and selects each of the ping failures, each of the different types, and then we have a script that parses that out and produces a nice graph and chart about each of the app pools and their average uptime and how often these different events happen. That way we can see which of our app pools is the most healthy, which of our app pools is the least healthy, and we can start our serious investigations.
Hey, Jeff, quick question for you.
Yes, sir.
Now, one of the things that you had as a, I guess, a prerequisite knowledge about this is the structure of the event viewer. And that is things like you showed the message, you also showed the actual string and things of that nature. How does someone, if they don't have that, so let's say, intimate knowledge of event viewer, granted they're used to the scroll and just view the data, how do they learn about that?
Yeah, if you can get used to this, going to the event viewer and seeing this data here, right, then from log parser, if we just do the -i evt -h, that will give us the fields. Right? Now, right off of that, you may or may not know what an event type name is. But you know what? If you do log parser -i evt select event type name from system, and we'll keep that where in there, where source name equals W3 service. And when we hit enter here, we see that is an error event. Now if we switch back to the event property, one other thing I forgot to do is order by time generated descending. Let me scroll up a little bit there so you can see it. So we want to get the last events, not the first events.
You need to close that parentheses, correct? Or no?
No. I've got to add time generated. Time generated. And yeah, I could close this double quote. I don't have to. The command prompt automatically does it for me.
Okay.
And you're almost getting me a headache here because I forgot my comma too.
Well, I certainly didn't mean to do that, but ultimately what you're saying is the log parser has all those field names for them so they can start investigating and correlating between what they see in the event viewer.
Exactly.
And that's what they're going to do in log parser.
That's exactly what I do. Right? And I happen to know that the stuff in the top part of the event tends to each be a different column. The type, the event ID, the category. The description tends to either be the message, which is exactly what you see in the description, and the strings, which is a parsed down version of the message. Right. So if you just look at this, look at the different events, and instead of saying select time generated on the event type, you could just say select everything. Let's do that real quick. Select everything. Right. You get a lot of data, but if we just look and start parsing, you say, oh, look, a process serving application pool. That looks very similar to a process serving application pool. And then when we look at the strings data, we see key pieces of that message are embedded here in the strings. So we see the app pool ID, we see the number, and we see the error code. Right? And it's just simple investigation of what pieces match, and then you can know what's in your strings field.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's what I was really looking for. And also to just point out to folks that if you're not familiar with log parser, Jeff mentioned earlier, if you go to, back to the iswebcastseries.com, if you go to there's a couple of webcasts on there. One, Jeff himself did tips and tricks for performance, with using, for IS6, and that has a lot of log parser scripts. Also helps you understand how to use it, along with data mining, which really gets into the intrinsic of LogParser along with LogParser.com. Those three places, if you're not familiar with LogParser, then make sure you go and visit those. But you answered my question perfect. Thank you, Jeff.
You bet you do. Thanks for jumping in there. Now let's switch back to the slides. And so that's kind of a wrap-up for the event log and the way to use LogParser to mine that data. Now, oddly enough, the WMI approach to the event log is very similar because WMI, again, uses the SQL-like query streams. So on to debugging memory usage. With memory usage, right, there's a lot of things you got to worry about, especially in today's wonderful age of managed code. You know, most websites, unfortunately, aren't just made up of one type of content. We usually have some static content. We might have an IFAPI extension or an IFAPI filter. We might have some classic ASP still hanging around. Or it might be mostly ASP.NET. And at Microsoft.com, yes, we have all of that content and more. And it's a wonderful thing some days. Now, what you can do, the things you need to worry about with memory are how much memory the process in general is consuming, and then specifically how much memory is ASP.NET consuming. So if we look at these first four counters, they're just generic counters to the system that tell us which process, you know, which WP processes are consuming the most memory. Now here I just show W3 WP, but if you have more than one app pool, you'll have a W3 WP1, a W3 WP2, and you have to have these set of counters for each one of those app pools to really understand which ones are consuming your memory. One of the great things in the 2.0 version of the CLR is the .NET CLR memory process ID counter was finally added. In the 1.1 version, it was a real pain to try to figure out how your .NET memory counters map to your system memory counters. Now with this process ID, it becomes very simple. All you have to do is match up the two process IDs. You know, okay, the ID process and the process ID. And don't ask me why they named them different. But if we look at the .NET counters besides that one, we have a byte in all heaps, and a percent time in GC, and the different sizes for the different heaps. And tomorrow, I believe it is, tomorrow or Wednesday, we're going to have some really good in-depth training on these counters, but I'm just going to get into them a little bit. Right? So the first thing we look at is, look at the private bytes for the process. This is a system. Right? And if that private byte counter is significantly larger than the number of bytes in all heaps from .NET, then we want to look at some unmanaged code. That's probably going to be a problem. So we'll have a slide in a couple of slides here that talks about debugging the unmanaged code. If the .NET bytes in all heaps is pretty close to the private bytes, meaning within 10 or 15%, then we probably need to do a managed memory investigation, try to figure out what in managed memory is using all our memory. Now, I said randomly 10 or 15%. It's really hard to tell by looking at one instance of time. What you really want to do is look how these memory, how this memory changes through time. So you check it every hour or every half hour and see if your system memory, your process memory is going faster than your managed memory to determine which one of these kind of investigations you need to do. So let's start with debugging unmanaged memory. So what are possible problems? Well, the two main problems are fragmentation and leaks. So with fragmentation, what do you see? You usually see process virtual memory significantly larger than process private bytes. Now, both those counters were in that previous slide. And virtual memory is the memory that the process thinks it might use sometime, and private bytes is the memory that actually is using, you know, for the completely non-technical definitions of both of those. So what does fragmentation mean? I like to think of it as your memory looks like Swiss cheese. Because you have some memory in use, and then you have some free space, and then you have memory in use again. And how does it happen? Well, there are a couple of little ways that it can happen. You have the assembly loading fragmentation, which means as you add an assembly, the assembly manager only allocates 64K chunks of memory at a time. So if your assembly that you're loading, your .dll file, is only 5K, you now have a 59K hole that can never be used. Why? Because it's already been allocated by that memory manager, even though it didn't really need that much. And the other way you can get fragmentation is with big little allocation patterns, which I will go in depth in the next slide. So, for debugging fragmentation issues, I'm not going to show you how to do it, because Jim Dobbins will be showing you extensively how to do that on Wednesday. The other major issue, we said, were leaks, so fragmentation leaks. And leaks is just when the memory is going up and up and up and never comes back down. And some tools to investigate leaks are LeakDiag, which is available from Microsoft, and UMDH, which is another tool, a little bit more difficult, a little bit more in-depth, that's available from Microsoft.com as well. But unfortunately, we're not going to get into those today. Memory fragmentation, bad allocation patterns. What we have here is mixed-size allocations. If the system only allocated memory in one size, you would never end up with fragmentation because every allocation would fit where the last allocation was freed. The problem tends to be that you allocate large sizes and small sizes next to each other. So what we see here is we see that we allocate a big piece, this black area, and then we allocate a smaller piece, this purplish-reddish area, right? And then we free our first allocation. Right? So right now we have free memory, used memory, and free memory. The blue is free, the purple is used. And then we allocate another small piece. Well, the memory manager finds the first spot that it can fit that piece into, and lo and behold, it's where that big black piece used to be. So it stuffs that pink one in that smaller allocation into that bigger allocation, which is fine. We're using memory. That's great. And the problem is the system then tries to allocate another big piece. And what happens? Well, it can't fit down where the small one was anymore, so it has to allocate a new piece off the end. Now, if we allocate another smaller section, you notice it would not fit in this part that's blue left, so it would have to go on the end. If we free that black part out again and allocate another purple one, it's going to fit in the spot where that black one is, and we now have two spots where we're looking like Swiss cheese in the middle of this fragmentation. So if we repeat this over and over and over again, you can fragment yourself out of memory fairly quickly. And once again, the trend you're watching there is virtual memory will be fragmented more than private bytes. Note that the result looks the same when you have a memory leak. The difference being you don't have to deallocate. Right? The memory leak will just look like this instance here with the let's skip a different line here. This part right through here where you get a red and then a blue and then a red. Right? That's what the memory will look like with that keep loading leak.
Hey Jeff, on that topic, I know there's a couple of different pieces of technology that Microsoft produces. One that comes to mind is the MDAC in the past has had some issues with how much they would allocate at the beginning and the end. Do you have any overarching, hey, by the way, if we're using this, that tend to run into allocation issues, and maybe are they configurable?
I don't have. The best news is managed code gets rid of fragmentation for us. Right. So our best advice is to move to managed code if you're having fragmentation issues. Right. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, I know that in the past, and it's been 2-3 years, MDAC had a registry key that you could control how much they would attempt to alloc in this case, because you would start running into these problems. I didn't know if there was other technology, maybe besides that, and they may have fixed that in more recent builds. But like I said, I didn't know if there was other technology. So it does answer the question. I was just curious if you knew of certain technology that didn't, that ran into this a lot.
Yeah, I'm not going to say no technology runs into this a lot. Anything has the capacity to, but when they're using the default heaps that Ansible provides. Now, with Windows 2003, Microsoft provided a new low fragmentation heap, which is a good option if your application can support it. IS6 decided not to have it on out of the box, because there is some compatibility issues, and we did see some like Zappy's breaks, so we decided not to support it out of the box. If you're not using any customized Zappy's, if you're only using stuff provided by Microsoft, then you should be fairly safe to enable the low fragmentation heap, and I believe you can find that out on the KB articles.
I'll try to take a look at that, see if I can't provide that for everybody.
Okay. So, that is fragmentation, bad allocation patterns. So, let's move on to managed memory, right? Now that we're done with leaks and fragmentation in unmanaged code. Now let's talk about managed. And there are two or three, there's just two real ways that you start having memory issues with managed code. The first one is caching. And this tends to be people just throwing all kinds of stuff in the cache and not worrying about it coming back out again. And that's just a bad thing to do in the end. The memory management system in .NET, which you'll get a whole lot of on Wednesday and tomorrow, actually, works best when things don't live past the garbage collection. Now, do I have garbage collection on this one? Yeah, it's on the next slide. We'll talk a little bit more about garbage collection in just a second. But the idea is with the cache, only put things in the cache if you think you're going to get a cache hit. Right? That seems obvious, but way too many developers and code producers just want to put everything in the cache. You don't want to think about, is this item likely to get used again? Why? Well, because you've got the cache there, you might as well use it. Right? If you're good about only putting in things that are going to get hit again, you don't have to worry as much about flushing items that aren't in there that aren't used for a long period of time. However, if you're using the ASP.NET cache, which everybody should be using because it's a wonderful thing, there are parameters that you can pass that tell it how long to keep something in, how long in between hits to let something live before it's used again. And both those parameters should be used. And here at Microsoft.com, we try to enforce that practice to make sure that valid things are getting cached, and if it's not being used, it gets flushed out of the cache. So how to monitor how many things are in the cache? You can look at ASP.NET applications, cache total entries. And this number, once again, you don't just want to look at it at one period of time. You want to look at it over time and see how it's increasing. Also in the debugger, using the SOS extension, which is in the .NET installation directory, meaning your Windows directory, / Microsoft.NET, / framework or framework 64 if you're on a 64-bit machine, / the version, / and that's where you'll find SOS. That's a great extension for doing many things that you do in the debugger, like dumping out the heap. And if you do this dump heap /sat, it'll show you the number of types for each type of thing, how many of those are in the cache. Obviously, you don't want to do this on your production machine while it's in production. You want to pull it out of production or to take a crash dump of that production machine. Fragmentation, like I said before, doesn't exist in .NET because of garbage collection. And garbage collection is how the .NET framework takes care of its memory management. The idea is, as you use memory, it gives that memory right back to the .NET when you're done with it. The .NET just lets it sit there until it decides it doesn't have enough memory, at which time it will go through and collect the garbage and throw it all away. Now, this is good because you get rid of fragmentation, you get rid of memory, a number of other memory issues, including most of the unmanaged leak scenarios. But it's bad in that when that garbage collection does happen, you can get in cases where there's a lot of collections happening at once, and your performance can be impacted by it, which you will find about tomorrow in Jeff Stuckey's wonderful presentation on the GC. Now, for leaks in managed code, we don't tend to have the same type of leaks that we had in unmanaged code. In unmanaged code, it's very easy to leak any kind of object. With managed code, it's a little harder since you have to have something that's keeping track of that object. One of the ways we saw was with the dynamic assembly, which is scripts in your XSL transforms. So the idea is you want to do some XML transformation, but you have some scripts in the transformers. With .NET's default behavior, you end up generating a dynamic assembly every time that transform happens. Now, if you don't choose the default parameters, there are ways that you can use that functionality and have it cache the transform, and then you don't have a dynamic assembly created each time. And I do believe Jim Dobbin will show you how to use that technology. And I think so for memory management, so I'm not going to show any demos for memory usage because, like I said, tomorrow's presentation and Wednesday's presentation are all going to be about memory management and how to debug those scenarios. So let's move on to debugging the CPU. In the CPU, we've got a few counters again. Let's start with counters like we always do. We have the system counters provided for the process and the processors. And then we also have context switching. Plus, we have the .NET counters. Again, with I don't know why I have three instances of process ID there, but we do. So, oddly enough, only one of those is needed. Amazing, isn't it? But we want to look at the percent time in GC and the request per second in ASP.NET. One of the key things to keep in mind when you're dealing with CPU usage and when dealing with most performance analysis in general is your per second numbers generally don't matter as much, oddly enough. What you really care about is your per unit of work. In the web server case, it's per ASP.NET request or per response. So that's why we look at number of exceptions thrown per second, but we really don't care about how many exceptions are thrown per second. Right? Maybe we're throwing 1,000 per second, or maybe we're throwing 5 per second. Those numbers may or may not be important. If we're throwing 5 exceptions per second, but we're only doing 5 requests per second, we might have a problem. But if we're throwing 5 exceptions per second, but we're doing 5,000 requests per second, we might not have a problem. So you need to keep in mind that it's not about the per second data as much as it's about per unit of work. Unfortunately, they don't provide the account of that. You have to do that math yourself. So the decision tree. If the percent time in GC is high, and there are large changes in memory used, or there's an increase in .NET CLR memory Gen 2 collections, we need to go investigate the GC. And once again, we're going to have some presentations this week about just how to do that. Now, if the exceptions per request is high, we want to investigate exceptions. Otherwise, you need to actually go start looking at code path. So we're going to start with debugging GC, once again, high level, because we've got two great presentations coming up on this. But here's some specific counters that help you understand where collections are happening. As you'll get more information tomorrow about the generations involved in GC, for now let's just make sure you understand that memory has two or three states. And the idea is, for things that come and go regularly, say when we connect and we make an ASP.NET request, it needs to do some things like get the URL you requested. Well, that URL really doesn't have to live longer than the response lives. So as soon as the response is done, we might as well clean up that URL. So those kind of things live in that generation zero. The idea for generation zero is it's the temporary stuff, the stuff that's going to go away soon. Now, to make sure that stuff from generation zero doesn't accidentally end up in generation two, which is the stuff that's supposed to stay around for a long time, say your cache items, right? They put another generation in the middle. And the idea is, if something outlives generation zero, meaning it doesn't get thrown away when generation zero runs its generation collection, then we move it to generation one. And at some future period in time, generation one is going to collect its memory, hopefully less often than generation zero does. And generation one, anything that outlives generation one, will move into generation two. So things in generation one are either moving to generation two or they're getting thrown away. Generation zero is the same way it is moving to generation one, it's getting thrown away. Hopefully, in the end, only the things that really are supposed to live forever live on to generation two. Okay. Now the other interesting thing to look at is the size here, and if these sizes change radically over time, then that's something you'd want to keep track of and realize that you're having some very interesting memory usage and GC usage. You need to keep track of that and track that closer. So what do we do? Well, what decision tree says, if Gen 2 is large, investigate as a memory leak, meaning instant caching. Right? Those are the things that should end up in Generation 2. If the large object heap, which I can get into and I will, is large, then look for specific kinds of large objects being in the cache. So the idea here is, even though they don't have fragmentation issues, they have a highly performant memory management system up to a certain size. And with all software, different sizes of inputs determine what kind of algorithms you want to use? Well, they've determined through analysis that somewhere in the 64K to 128K size, the memory manager's algorithms deteriorate in performance. So they found that if they created a new kind of heap with a slightly different memory management algorithm and called it the large object heap, then they could get better performance out of all their memory systems. That's what the large object heap is. Now, for web servers, the kind of stuff that usually goes in the large object heap are those things like XML strings. At least that's what we've seen often, where somebody has a large amount of XML that they want to parse and deal with, and they'll pull that in, and it will take up vast amounts of space, as it were. So, once again, interesting stuff that we're going to get more in-depth presentations both from Jim Darbin on Wednesday and from Jeff Stuckey tomorrow. So I highly recommend you step in and watch those presentations as well. So for debugging the CLR exception, what do you do? Well, once again, here are the counters we're looking for. We see exceptions thrown per second or just number of exceptions thrown. And we compare either of those to either our request per second or our total number of requests. But we can get an idea of about how many requests it takes to get an exception. Now, in general, and this should be obvious, but it isn't always, exceptions are for exceptional cases. Right? Some programmers like to use exceptions to just pass information around, and that's not a wise use of our resources. We want exceptions to be for when an exception truly happens. Now, again, we have the process ID so we can know which app pool is causing these painful points. Right? We also, a large number of exceptions, specifically those not handled by your code, will be handled by ASP.NET. And ASP.NET will log an entry in the event log to say that an exception happened that was unhandled. So, once again, we go back to log parse and we'll find it, and we'll show you that demonstration in just a few minutes. There's also, the event log events are very, very wonderful because they give you almost all the information that you need to debug it. They give you a full stack trace, they give you the URL and the file that were involved. But if you can't, then you can also help into a debugger and follow exceptions. Because it could be that the ASPX page itself actually catches all exceptions and just swallows them and doesn't report it anywhere, which we've had a number of pages go like that. And it takes us debugging down to figure out which code paths are throwing these exceptions and where they're getting caught. And then going and working with the developer and the content owner to produce better content for us. Right. Now, this is a demonstration that I gave in my last presentation, right, and pretty much copy and paste, but we're going to do a couple of different things with it, hopefully. Right. So here's an example of an event viewer pop-up box, just like I saw earlier, but this one is for an ASP.NET exception. Right. An unhandled exception has occurred, and it gives you some signs and stuff. Well, last presentation I gave you a nifty little script for finding those. Okay. And you notice this one uses that case statement stuff pretty heavily. Why? Well, because they formatted each of the different event types differently. Right? And so this is really not just looking at exceptions, but it's looking at anything reported by ASP.NET 2.0.527.0. And it's formatting into the nicer way than what we usually see. So if we're not looking at the event viewer, right, we hook up the debugger and we get the correct symbol path and we load sos.dll, which is our friendly extension for debugging.NET things. Right. We're going to start with an sxclr and hit go on the debugger. And sxclr tells the debugger to break on any exception in the CLR, so any managed code exception. Once you've broken into the exception by applying the load, then we're going to dump stack objects, and then we're going to dump objects until we get to see the exact thing that we want to see, and we'll find the code path that we care about. So, let's do that now. I have produced a page that will produce an exception. And it is on my local host.
So while you're doing that, Jeff, I want to make sure that everybody knows, if you're not aware of live meetings capability, go to F5 for a full screen. do. It kind of helps when you switch in between the browser and the command prompt and maybe Notepad and things like that. So use F5.
Yes. I was supposed to remind you of that, wasn't I?
You were, but that's okay. I won't hold it against you.
Well, that's not what we're supposed to see.
I will hold it against you, though, if you don't get this to work.
That's just because I can't spell and I can't remember things. Let's check and see that we actually do have session.asdx here, and we do. There's what we're supposed to see. Notice if this were a real emergency, there would be something more useful here. That is because my code for doing this, and I'm probably switching too fast for people, but I'll pull up a Notepad on this code. This is the actual content of the ASDX page. Notice all I'm doing is throwing a new exception, which says, if this were a real emergency, there would be something more useful here. So, if I'm running localhost and I don't have custom errors on, or I have custom errors set to present stuff localhost, then I would see this wonderful message that says, turn on debug 2 and you'll get the code. Which is great if you don't mind enabling debug 2. Some of us don't enjoy doing that. So what we can do is, we can determine which worker process we're dealing with. And I use tlist. We could have also used the ISAP script. And then we're going to put this worker process, 2396, into a debugger. And we do that by running our debuggers.
Notice that you're using the 64-bit and not the 32-bit, so just an FYI, you're on a 64-bit machine if anybody was curious.
Yes, I am on a 64-bit machine, and I have been popping back and forth between using 32-bit worker processes and 64-bit worker processes. And obviously, I don't know what I'm doing. Great. So first thing we're supposed to do, we're supposed to set up our symbol path. And here at Microsoft, we have a nice symbol server, so we can find the symbols anytime we need to. And we reload those symbols to make sure we have the up-to-date stuff. And then we're going to load our SOS, C:\Windows:\Microsoft.net, framework 64, I'm on a 64-bit machine. I'm using the released version of 2.0. And yes, this is my office machine, not some Microsoft web server, so don't believe you're getting any fun information out of this. This is just something on my box. But SOS exists everywhere. So I just did .help for SOS. And that loads the DLL so I can start using it when we need to. And it also lets me see what the help is. One fell swoop, I get all that great information. So let's fxcclr. And again, that tells the debugger that we want to catch the next exception and break on it. And then we're going to say go. Now we're going to go back to our repro scenario and apply load by F5. And hey, it's taking a while. Why is it taking a while? The debugger is broken in, which is great. So now what's the first thing we can do? Well, we can see where we are in the stack, and with 2.0, wonderfully, it's been integrated into the K command versus having to run the CLR stack command from SOS. And we see that system.web is rendering its children, and our page called throwException.astx is running its render control, which means it's actually going to try to show people what it's doing. And in that control, it's throwing an exception, raising an exception. So what kind of an exception got raised? Well, let's see. If we do dump stack objects, or DSO, right, which is one of those SOS commands, which now that we've run the help, it's automatically available to us. We get a nice scrolling list of all of the objects that are on the stack. Well, what we really care about is the top of this stack. And there's this nice exception with an object memory reference. And these numbers are big because, once again, I'm running on a 64-bit machine. If I were on a 32-bit machine, they would have just started with this C number. So if we feign, jump, obj, or just do for short, and we give it that memory address, it's going to dump out all the interesting information about that object. So you can see that this object has a name, and it has a method, and it has a message. And pretty much everything but that message is zero, which means we're not that interested in it. But with that message, which is a string object, we can go find out what does the message say by, again, saying do space and the address. Just as a side note, time and time again, I've pasted the underscore message there. No matter how many times I try, it doesn't work. It's amazing. So just make sure you're pasting in the addresses every time. So we see a string. If this were a real emergency, there would be something more useful here. So, in almost all cases, when you have an exception thrown, the developers do have useful messages there. File not found, the file's not found on the system, authentication failed, all kinds of interesting things that usually have real strings. For my sample case, I created a really bogus one. But it's very simple to get back to this, right? It was SXECLR, hit go, wait for your repro to happen. You dump out the stack objects to find the exception. You dump out the exception to find the message, address. You dump out the message to see what the thing actually was. Right. Simple, simple steps.
If we now, I might want to state the obvious here, but we wouldn't want to be doing this in a production environment.
Yes, by the way, I'm broken in. Remember, our web page is still trying to load. So if you have 3,000 customers connected on this machine, all 3,000 are still waiting to load. That is, stating the obvious, hopefully not. But it is a good thing to remind people. And with this scenario particularly, versus most of the other scenarios, you can't just create a crash dump as easily and not impact a production environment. When you're doing the memory analysis and those sorts of things, you can usually create a dump file and then analyze it offline. But with the exceptions, you actually have to do break on the repro. But this is where you can, to once again, be working in pre-production and not production environments. Pre-production environments, usually you can take them offline for 5 minutes or 10 minutes to do this analysis. So, let's quit our debugger. And just for fun, let's use Log Parser. Select. Star from application. Why do I say application? Well, ASP.NET doesn't log stuff into system. It logs it into application. Source name. I'm going to change a little bit. I'm going to say like, because I can never remember all of ASP.NET. I'm going to say like ASP.NET %. We're going to get anything that they claimed was from ASP.NET. Let's order by time generated descending. Time generated is one word, not two. And we hit enter. Now if I type correctly, we get lots of cool information. And boy, this thing's scrolling on my screen. Why is it scrolling so much? Well, you see that at the end, it actually gave us a stack, which is incredibly useful. So we can actually see exactly what the problem was. Now you notice in this case that some parsing and some code stuff that I had fun doing. If we scroll up a little bit, we should see our render control internal state render process request. Render control 1 for throw exception ASPX. So there's our stack, which we talked about seeing in the event viewer. And we can parse this out very nicely. You notice that it's all actually in the streams field again, and they are token delimited by the pipe sign. So you go through and you extract token on the pipe sign, and you figure out which one you wanted to have your stack or your page, which is, look, the full URL and the client IP address, which may or may not be interesting, and the actual directory where it existed, which is very nice to get to. So lots of great information in here, that you can simply brush with water pressure.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to say, during the scrolling and some of the other, the command didn't show up real well for everybody.
Okay.
Is there any chance you can maybe just redo it again, maybe clear the screen and so it's at the top of our screen so that we can...
Let me scroll some more first, though.
Okay, no problem. I just want to let you know there was some feedback about that. So
great.
If you do, that'd be great.
Great. So the command is at the top, which is just a simple log parser. Select everything from application or source name like ASP.NET. And once again, to figure out which parts we want, we would go over to our event viewer. We would look at the event properties for the event we care about, and we'd scroll down. And remember, each one of these things is probably going to be a string in the strings column. So, for example, throw exception, request URL. That was in that type, the limited set of things. So, once we know we're looking for this URL, I'm going to say top one to make it scroll to the left. How's that? Now we know we're looking for that URL. We say, hey, there's that URL. And that's the only time it shows up. So which number is that? That's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so on and so forth. Somewhere around 17, as I recall. And so we say extract token strings, comma, 17, comma, and then the pipe symbol inside single quotes. So instead of star, let's try to get that. And we'll try a few times and see how close we get. So extract token, the strings field. Let's guess at number 17. I haven't counted all the way. And of course, we need that time generated to be able to order by time generated descending. Oh, it's exception. Where does that single word exception exist? Exception is up here. So 18, 19. So lot number 19.
Just to clarify, is that all you're simply doing is you're providing a string field, and then you're choosing an arbitrary number that is individualized between the pots. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, that's how you're...
I'm choosing one of those tokens to try to figure out which token that I care about. So I randomly decided I care about the URL. So I'm trying to figure out which number is the URL to show people how you go through this process of, well, I have great information, but how do I start parsing it in the piece I want?
Absolutely. Somebody asked about the EBT, about the using this. Is all ASP.NET exceptions that are not handled by the application, are they bubbled up to the event viewer?
Anything that ASP.NET handles will be bubbled into the event viewer, yes. Right. Now, with the 2.0 version of WIDBI, or version of .NET, you can get into a scenario where something like a callback function gets called and throws an exception. I'm just going to put out a warning here. With 1.1, that exception would have been swallowed and nobody would have known better. It would just disappear. The exception would disappear. With 2.0, they decided that that was a security risk. And so what they do by default instead is exit the process if there's an unhandled exception. So you need to make sure if your developer's writing callback-style functions, these are not functions that are handling the main ASP.NET request response, but there's something that sets up as a callback that maybe logs something later on. So if those functions throw an exception, they can exit your process. Now, IIS sees that as a ping failure or a process unexpectedly terminated failure, and log something for your point of view that IIS realizes something like that. But .NET doesn't think there's anything bad, and by default, they don't log an event on it. That's just a fair warning. That again, only if your developers are using callback functionality, where they're providing a callback function to handle some logging or something similar. So, this is how, going back to what we did in the log parser, we got that URL that we cared about. So, you know, we could run that same thing and say, as URL. Now we have a nifty formatted column that shows us the URL that we care about. Now once again, my presentation last time showed a lot of the same stuff, but it came out with an in script that was significantly more intricate. Why? Because each different event ID is formatted slightly different. So if it's an unhandled exception, it's going to have one format. If it's some other event logged by ASP.NET, it will have a different format. So you have to go through the same process of determining which token you want out of that streams field for each different kind of event. So, back to the slides. For general CPU debugging, there are a few tools that are available. And the first I list here is PSTAT, and again, this is not an exhaustive list. The first tool here is PSTAT, which shows you thread usage in the process. So it's process stat. I highly recommend that you, when you run PSTAT, you export it out, you use the right angle bracket, the greater than sign, and send it into a text file, and then open up Notepad and look through it, because it's going to dump out every thread in every process and give you some information for each of those. If you're working over a terminal service, it can be a real drag on your system, slow everything down. Now, PSAT is good to see which threads are using CPU and which threads are context switching and a few other things, but it doesn't give you any information regarding which code is doing that. Right? It does let you move from being just wondering what's going on, which process, to okay, which thread in that process, and then when you look into the debugger, you can actually see which code is sitting on that thread, right? Which in cases where runaway threads is very useful. Right? We get fewer and fewer of those as we move to managed code, though. The second tool is Krenrate. And Krenrate is a tool available in the resource guide. Thank you, memory. It's available in the resource guide, and it shows you which processes and which functions, which DLLs and which functions in those DLLs are consuming the most time on the CPU. It does this by sampling the CPU to see what's there every once in a while. Okay. Now, this is useful because you can see, hey, we're spending all of our time in this piece of code. Unfortunately, it doesn't give you that stack trace, so you don't know how to get to that piece of code. For example, when I was on the IIS team as a tester, I was doing performance work for IIS, and lo and behold, stream copy was taking all of our time. That wasn't very useful. We didn't know who was calling stream copy, but we did know it was stream copy, so then we could break into the debugger and see, you know, who was calling stream copy how many times, just put a breakpoint on stream copy and see who fired it. So, Krenrate, while useful, still lacks a little bit in the ease of use department. The good thing it does is it's one of the better tools at analyzing the kernel usage, especially looking at context switching and hot locks in the kernel. Great, great use there. The third tool I list here is the F1 Profiler, and this is available with Visual Studio's Team Systems 2005, right? And it's a really great tool. It does the same kind of work that Krenrate does by allowing you to check the CPU every hundredth of a second or thousandth of a second to see what's running on the CPU. But then it gives you a nice report, including stack traces, so you can actually see which code paths are the extensive code paths. Now, obviously, Visual Studio's Team Systems 2005 is not free, while the other two tools are free. But I think it's probably worth the money for your development team to get in and look at what's going on and improve performance of your system.
Now, it also has an awesome testing mechanism.
It does.
Stress testing and app testing.
So yeah.
That's another reason to look at it as well. And we did a webcast on that back in November.
All right, great to know.
Yeah, that we kind of touched on, so I just thought I'd throw that in there. Quick question, F1 Profiler and PSAT, could you tell, are those also resource kit guys? Where do they get PSAT? I know you see Krenrate.
Yeah, PSAT and Krenrate are both in the resource kit.
Okay, so they're both in the resource for Windows.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, you can search the web and find them as well. And F1 Profiler, like you said, is part of Team Systems. And I should not have implied that it was the only good thing in Team Systems, because there's actually a lot of great stuff in there. One of the tools we're using from Team Systems is the code analysis piece, which actually allows us to define rules that we don't want people to break. For example, one of the things we do is we don't want people to call response.redirect from their ASP.NET page and kill the thread it throws a, by default, it throws a thread abort exception, right, which is not so good for performance. So we actually created a plugin for Team Systems, Visual Studio's Team System, that allows you to say, throw an error on compile if the redirect call doesn't have the right parameters. Team Systems is great stuff. Like Chris mentioned, there's a great test suite in there and good stress client. So good stuff you should investigate, you know, owning. The one problem with the F1 Profiler is it doesn't support 64-bit operating systems. And I was more than just somewhat annoyed by that, because I was always running my process on this box in the SysWow version, meaning I was running a 32-bit process on my 64-bit machine. And I popped up F1 and was going to get ready to do a presentation on, you know, have some slides here to show you how cool F1 was. And it popped up a little message that said, we're sorry, we don't support SysWow. We don't support 32-bit process analysis on a 64-bit machine. And I said, well, that's slightly annoying. And so I went over and I changed all my IIS settings, my ASP.NET settings, so that I was running 64-bit worker processes. And that only took a little time. And I got it all up and running, and so I went into Profiler, and I said, okay, Profiler, work again. And it said, we're sorry, we don't support profiling 64-bit processes. So I was more than slightly annoyed.
I'm sure you've let them know about that.
I have let them know about that, yes.
So you mentioned, in some ways, curious, you mentioned the response.redirect that you added into that team system.
Yeah.
You more than wet their whistle. And if you don't really like them doing that, what do you recommend in that place?
What we do there is we have our, it's fine to do response.redirect. We just force them to use the correct parameter of false on the end. And then they have to deal with the fact that they're not getting a thread abort exception. So our developers have to go through and actually return through all the code to get back to the end of the response, rather than just abort out.
So you can't do a response.redirect and then a response.end. Is that what you're...
A response.end will, oddly enough, do the exact same thing.
So, okay. So
it will throw that same abort exception.
Okay, and so that's not, that's one of the things you don't recommend folks do.
Correct.
In your environment.
And it goes back to that. But, you know, any kind of exception is fairly expensive, and, you know, just like you'll get into that very deeply tomorrow, just how expensive they are. The thread abort is especially expensive because the thread has to go away, and a new thread has to get started up. So in our shared environment, that's not such a good thing, and we saw that that did impact our performance. So that's one of the rules that we set up.
Do you have any examples of how kern rate output might look like? Do you have that on your box?
I have kern rate on my box, and can switch over. I don't have a sharing slide set up here, but I can dump back into the last sharing slide.
Hey, just make it happen.
Make it happen.
But all for the customer base.
All right. So I should have kern rate in my path. Oh boy, that was less effective. Hold on just a second. Let me get the, make sure I get the right version. Maybe I have kern rate in my path, in the right spot. No. Maybe I don't. Chris, you might have to tell people to...
Well, is anybody else going to talk about it this week, that they can come back if they're interested?
Not planning on it, but we could definitely have somebody slide that in there, yeah.
Yeah, so for the person that asked that question, anybody else that's interested in kern rate, you could certainly come probably between Tuesday or Wednesday. I know that Jim and Jeff are both listening on. We'll try to get that squared away since you sound seem to be interested. There's a few questions about that.
Yeah. What it gives you is it gives you an output of which URLs. So you would say kern rate space dash T and give a process ID similar to what we did with the CDB. And it will tell you which DLLs in that process are using the time based on a percentage of time. So it's say 78% for NTDLL, for instance. And then you would add a dash Z parameter to zoom in to that process, that DLL, so dash Z space NTDLL, and it would dump out each of the functions in that process that are used, and then give you a percentage of time for each of those. It's actually fairly intuitive once you understand those basic parameters.
And they don't need any, inside symbols or anything of that nature.
No.
Basically all built in.
They do need symbols, but just the public symbols should be just fine for it.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. Great. Even in the file system. So what are we looking at here? We're looking at things like high queues on the disk. and lots of reads and writes in the disk. And when you're debugging this, trying to find out what's going on, there's kind of two time periods when you're doing it. One is you're looking at live data, trying to figure out what's happening right now, and see what the blocking issues are. And for that, I'm going to recommend going to sysinternals.com, which is not a Microsoft site, so, but it's good tools found in good places. And so we use sysinternal FileMon to go see what's actually happening on the system at this very point in time. And you can filter down to specific directories. And I know there's lots of good information on the web about how to use FileMon, so we're not going to go into that as much. The other one is using LogParser to do some post-analysis. So we know that something bad happened at a certain point in time. We can go back and see what files are set at that time period, what files have that timestamp. Or maybe you can go see how much disk space is being used and those kind of things. So it's really which tool you're using is really determined by what you're trying to do. So once again, if you find your disks are slow, pull up FileMon and see what's going on those disks right then. If you want to find out where your space is being used, then LogParser is probably a better choice for you. So let's get right to a demonstration of good old LogParser again. So in this case, we're going to, I have taken the privilege of copying.
Hey, can we go ahead and clear screen? I hate to do that.
Come on.
Yeah, move it to the top there so that we...
Yeah, that's right.
It makes it a little bit easier.
Eye switching. Okay. So first, I'm just going to do a DIR. What I've done here is I've copied in the ASP.NET direct temp files directory off of our pre-production site. I've just copied the whole thing in to give a good random set of content to be parsing through. And we have a large number of V directories, as people can see. I'm going to clear that off again because we're going to start typing some log parser. LogParser -h -f input type of file system fs, and this will tell us what we can get off the file system. There's some interesting fields. We can get the path, the full path. We can get just the file name. Now, in general, I find that the path is more useful because you often have files that are named the same in different directories. We can get the size of each file, or we can get the versions, we can get company names, if that stuff has been put on the file. Right. We can also get the last write time or the last access time, which is very useful, especially for these temporary ASP.NET investigations, where we need to figure out when was the last time this was used. So one of the first things we're going to try here is, one other thing that's interesting is, preserve last access time. I like to use this, especially when I'm doing access analysis to see when the last time something was accessed. So if you leave this in the default of off, then as LogParser touches files, it will update the access time. So if your analysis is involving access time, you just blew your analysis out of the water. Right? So I like to leave the last access time set to whatever it was before LogParser came along. And to do that, we just preserve last access time on. So we have LogParser. -ifs, preserve last access time. Notice it's case insensitive. As long as I spelled it correctly, we're fine. And we turn that on. And then we're going to select, let's see, what should we select? Let's select the total size. So let's do the sum of the size. So this is going to sum all the sizes for all the files. From single quote, percent CD percent. Now, percent CD percent is a command line trick to say the current directory. You put those percents around it, and the command line prompt knows that you want to dump in the current directory. So we're going to just select the current size from the current directory. And we hit enter, and we wait a second here while we go through a bunch of data. Oh, whoops. Yeah, that'll work better. We don't have that sign. LogParser just looks at the current directory name itself rather than all the stuff under it. So in my directory structure here, we have 180 megabytes of data. Right. Now the question is, which of our virtual directories is consuming all that data? It's nice that we have 180 megabytes, but which one actually has all the content? So what we can do is extract the token on the path. And boy, we use the extract token a lot, don't we? And we want to look at token number 3. Why do I choose token number 3? Well, it's /presentation/temporary ASP.NET files/, and then that's going to be the vendor name. Right? When you're doing this in your system, you know, Windows, Microsoft.NET, Framework 64, version, temporary ASP.NET files, that number is not going to be 3. It'll be something else. So you'll need to go look and see which number that's going to be. But the token we're extracting on is the backslash. I'm going to call this thing Veter. And we want the phone size for all those. And we want to group by Veter. Notice case insensitive. I'm changing the case all over the place. Order by some size. Now I could have done some size as total size or something like that, or I could do it this way. Either way, log parser's fast. It makes up for your mistakes. So we wait a second again, because my poor disk is kind of slow. Did everybody see what I did wrong? I ordered by some size, but I wanted some size descending. Now I'll get the biggest files first. So we can see in this case, our Mindshare Veter has the largest amount of temporary content. Right? And then we can go find out why it has those temporary contents. Right? You can go and investigate that file system. Or the same with the Education Veter. The other thing we can do is we can use this same, and I'm going to scroll up some, because that bottom just isn't very nice to us. I'm going to copy and paste in that first part, because probably going to be always the same, along with the select. Now let's see, when was the last file access? And maybe we'll do this thing, which Veter was accessed last. Maybe that's what we'll do. Then we do max of the time, left, last, right time. So you can see which DLL was hit last. And last time, to make it easier to write later, from percent, CD percent, backslash asterisk, single quote, group by Veter, order by last time descending. So if I typed everything correctly, this should tell us each of the Veters, when they were last written to, and what time that was. So you can see I actually copied this stuff on the 24th at 14:56 p.m. 2:56 p.m. But the worldwide Veter was last written to on the 23rd. And this is useful for doing things like, oh, we know that something bad happened, let's say we know something bad happened on the 23rd at 14:57:26. Right. Let's pretend that we didn't know that directory was there. Let's add a where time last time. Actually, let's change this a little bit into the max.
So while you're doing that,
yep.
I'm going to go ahead and interject here. The group that you're presenting to you this week, they're all ghosters, along with me and everything. So as a joke, what we decided to do is make you furiously grab out your pencil, start writing down all these commands, and as each time your lead broke and got more frustrated with you, we thought that at the end of the presentation we'd tell you, by the way, we are going to make these scripts available to you later. So if you are worried about the fact that Jeff is typing fast or that Jeff is thinking outside the box and just doing things on the whim, don't worry about it. We'll get those files to you, and you can take those and run with them after the presentation.
But that's no fun.
It is not. See, I still think this was the best approach, was to have them break their lead more and more and more until the point that they were about to shoot us. But now, at this point, we're off the hook. You can relax and just watch and enjoy the show, and we will get those to you afterwards.
Yeah. So what we're going to do here is, let's off the cuff, way to go, decide, let's go see what was last written to during a certain time period. And so we have our last write time. We're going to say where that last write time is less than and we're going to create a new timestamp. Let's see what was written. Come on, man, I'm just going to say off 10, just to be safe. So let's say where it was less than 58, and then we have to tell log parser in that two timestamp function what format our timestamp is in. Year, dash, capital M for months, because we have minutes as well, DD for date, and then hour, minute, second. Okay. This is going to give us everything that was last written to before that time period. Well, let's pretend that we knew that and that last write time was greater than, I'm just going to copy and paste and change some numbers here because that's way too much to write again. I'm lazy. Let's say we want just stuff between 54 Ooh, you know what I forgot to do? Order by last right time descending. There we go. Let's say 58 and 57. That'll get rid of all these 1454s. So we'll let this run for just a second. We should come back with things that fall within that time frame. So look at that. Stuff. We no longer have the 1454s. We now started with 1457s. And if I didn't have that top pin, it would have spewed out a lot more data all the way up to the 1458. And then we can go in and see which of our readers got modified during that time. And we can do that investigation. Now those two timestamps, greater than less than, are really useful when you're looking at your IIS logs. And you want to see what requests came in during a certain time period. Because you know you had something bad happen during that time period. So, good, useful stuff. Back to the presentation. That is, unfortunately, about all the time we've got together, I believe, and we've covered the things we wanted to cover. We've talked about some general ways to find your get your data, and some tools to do that. We've also gone into some specific examples, looking at how to debug memory usage and CLR exceptions. And we also have talked about CPU and file system, and we'll get some more information on kernel rate for you, since people said they wanted to have that. And then a little bit about I don't remember talking about latency, and that's because I didn't. That was supposed to get caught in touch from this slide. But we had talked about the file system and how to use log parser to get cool data off of these different data sources. And with that, I believe I now turn the time back over to Mr. Chris.
Well, yes, you do, and that is an awesome presentation. I found it very interesting, especially from the fact that I'm not running operations, so it's always interesting to see the real world, the way that you guys accomplish finding that information. But more importantly, before everybody runs off, we are going to ask that you stick around. We want to hear your feedback. And when we say that is not a punchline or a buzzword. I'm telling you right now that the Microsoft.com folks will emphatically drive me crazy until these feedback information is provided to them. But I love it. That's the reason why that we love to have them come over and give these incredibly great presentations. And I do feel like they're very useful. I hope you do as well. And if you want to hear more or specific information, this is how these series get started, is from your direct feedback of what you want to hear from these invaluable, knowledgeable people that we have over here at Microsoft.com. So what I want to make sure that everybody's aware of before we turn it over to Janet to go ahead and close out the presentation, number one, we will try to stick around for a bit to talk about or go over some of the cool questions that you did ask. Very interactive crowd, and that is an excellent thing to see. Usually interested people ask very valuable questions. First and foremost, everything is going to be posted on the blog that you see here. One of the great things about the presentations that we're doing here is that we have someone capturing all those questions, unlike some of the other webcasts we do in our series. We have someone dedicated to doing that, and their job is to get that out on this blog. So if you're curious to see what you and your peers are asking of these folks, then you're welcome to visit that blog. We'll hopefully have that up there very, very soon. But I want to make sure that you realize as well that we're not done. By any means, we're actually talking about making sure that we get through debugging the CLR internals really looking at a Wednesday, the nasty and the nitty-gritty or the getting down and dirty with ASP.NET or Dynamic Assemblies. As well as Thursday and Friday, we're going to talk about some other things related to debugging, and I don't have those right here in front of me, but do not miss those 90 minutes. This week you are going to get about 4.5 hours worth of great stuff, if not more than that, from these guys. So make sure you don't miss on what we've already done back in November. We had the high availability architecture and looking at the web farms at Microsoft.com, and then, of course, the change and release management. These are just some of the information that we have available, as well as the Microsoft.com folks have been gracious enough to also put out on the How Microsoft IT Does It. Make sure that you go and visit the Microsoft.com site and look for MSCom Operations white papers talking about their platforms, talking about how they do troubleshooting, and as you can see here, some of the information that's available in front of you. We're trying to get their message out because they're invaluable. And then with that said, I'm going to go ahead and turn it back over to Janet for her to go over some of the last-minute things, but I do want to say thank you to everybody for joining us today. It has been our pleasure to bring, hopefully, what is useful information. Stick around, answer that survey, give us your feedback. We'll also follow up here in just a minute with your questions and your answer. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Chris. And I just want to remind everybody that you can print the PDF these slides to that file menu in your upper navigation bar. Now, there's lots of great information posted throughout here with lots of great URLs as well. So there's also the TechNet site. Just go to Microsoft.com/TechNet. Lots of wonderful information posted there. So we have, we'll have a few more minutes here to go over questions and answers. If anyone has any additional questions for Jeff, go ahead and submit those now. We'll get to them in a minute. Also, we do record all of our webcasts, so like I mentioned, you can watch your inbox tomorrow for an email with information about viewing this webcast on demand. You can also download a Windows media file, and that email will also include a link to the downloadable PowerPoint of today's webcast. So lots of great information there. You can also view all of our upcoming and previously recorded webcasts at Microsoft.com/webcast. In addition, if you have any content ideas or anything that you'd like to see us do differently, we'd love to hear from our audience. There's yet another URL posted there. I'll just point that out. And so I just wanted to point out that today's webcast was presented using the Microsoft Office Live Meeting technology. So you can get a free 14-day trial. Just go to Microsoft.com/presentlive. I want to point out that you can win this great little 40-gigabyte Creative Zen Ultra MP3 Windows Media Player. Just need to fill out that survey that we have coming up. So a little incentive there, but really your feedback, like Chris mentioned, is very important to us. So please do take a moment to fill out the survey before you log out. And let's see here. Are we having any additional questions coming in here?
Well, it looks like one question is in there. It says, is there anything, Jeff, this looks like right up your alley. Is there anything you want to, that they should be worried about with log parser and memory uses? Can they run log parser against a production server?
We do quite regularly. The one thing you want to look at is log parser will use all the CPU it can get, but it will only use one CPU at a time. So if you're running on a single cloud box, you might want to start log parser as lower priority, which is something we do when we do our remote execution.
How about taking the capability of the log parser on that topic? And it has a lot of capabilities of taking data that is on the server and stuffing it into like a SQL server, and
yes,
then you can really parse through that. Is that something that you guys do?
We don't do it as much just because of the amount of data we have. For our event logs, we do push most of those to a SQL server, and we parse those using log parser, and then some of them are probably using some other stuff to get into the SQL database.
So that could be a working way of going about doing it if you're not necessarily, you know, working with gigabytes of data on a regular basis.
Yeah, most definitely. And even a gigabyte of data, log parser parses faster than anything else I know.
Yep.
And you can run it remotely, which was pointed out. Now, there was one comment here that I wanted to clarify, and we'll fix it in the notes. But somebody said, log parser always deals with GMT time. How do I get it to work with my local time? And the way to do that is not to timestamp. The way to do that is to local time, the state times. What you have to do is you have to say to local time, open parentheses, to timestamp, open parentheses, date, comma, time, close parentheses. And that'll work for all your IS logs.
Is there any other good questions in here that you think we should certainly I want to make sure that everybody knows, if you are not coming to TechEd in Boston, first and foremost, these guys, a lot of them will be there. If you want to pick their brain, make sure that you check into Microsoft.com right TechEd, because Boston's going to be a good time, as it always is, but as well, you get to use them. They wanted to make sure that I let you guys know that. But also, are there any other last questions that you think is good that we should go over here before we go off the air?
I think they're all good, but I think they're all answered as well. So
what we're going to do is refer you at this time, unless you have, and you can type furiously as you're doing your survey. Keep in mind, you better be doing your survey. If you're not, we have something hidden in the background using log parser to find out if you're not doing your survey, and we will come hunt you down and find that out. That is the last part is a joke out of your, out of those that don't want to know. But with that said, just want to say thank you to everybody for coming. We'll see you back here tomorrow as well to go over the CLR internals, and Jeff Stuckey will join us to give us all that good information. Jeff Johnson, thank you very much for doing an excellent presentation and for joining us this week and helping all of our users get better at figuring out how to diagnose problems before they even know they have a problem.
Excellent. And I'll just remind everybody also that your feedback is very valuable. So please do take a moment to fill out that survey before you log out. And then again, I'd just like to extend a special thanks to both Chris and Jeff for today's presentation. So that concludes this TechNet Live meeting. I'd like to thank you all for joining us. And our audience may now all disconnect from the audio portion of this event.